So I wanted to start this week with a little bit of historical background. The Buddha was active in India around 2,500 years ago, and a few hundred years later, also in India, another great Buddhist teacher appeared called Nagarjuna. Now, when the Buddha started teaching, he made a sort of an announcement, and he said, "I'm now going to set rolling the wheel of the Dharma." That's the image he used, the wheel of the Dharma, the great wheel of the Dharma. And when Nagarjuna came along and gave some new teachings, effectively, this was sometimes known as the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma. And Nagarjuna realized that Buddhism had started, even after those few hundred years, to become a little bit rigid, a little bit hard, particularly in its definitions. People had lost the looseness and the openness of the Buddha's original teachings. And so he introduced the teachings on emptiness, in particular, the emptiness of the sense of one's own identity and the emptiness of one's sense of definite, fixed object in the world around you. So that was known as the second turning. But everything needs renewing. Always. That's one of the great things about Buddhism, it seems to me, is it refreshes itself periodically, and it's still doing that even today. So a third turning was needed. And a few hundred years later, in around 400 AD, a guy called Asanga turned up in Pakistan. He was born in Pakistan. What is now Pakistan? And he realized that, you know, important though Nagarjuna's teachings were, the idea of emptiness had become something rather abstract and remote for people. It had even become a little bit, people had interpreted it in rather nihilistic ways. They'd lost the sense of the importance of direct experience and the importance of compassion as well. So I wanted to say a little bit about Asanga and what he taught as the third turning of the wheel of the Dharma. I'm not going to give you a full life story, but he became a Buddhist monk, and his teacher told him to go on retreat. And he said, "What I want you to do is to go into that mountain cave and sit and meditate on the Bodhisattva Maitreya." So Maitreya is a mythical Bodhisattva, a figure representing Maitri. And Maitri is the Sanskrit word for metta. So if you like, he's the Bodhisattva particularly associated with kindness, friendliness and love. And Asanga's teacher felt that this was the practice he needed. He said, "Go in there, sit in the cave, try to conjure up Maitreya, try to visualize him, try to familiarize yourself with his presence until you really feel that you are connected with the Buddha of love, with Maitreya." So Asanga did as he was told, sat in the cave. 3 years later, he felt, "I'm not getting anywhere." He just felt, "I haven't done it. He's not, Maitreya has not turned up. He's let me down. I've been trying to meditate. You know, it's been nice in some ways, but I think that is it." So he reluctantly got up, packed his rucksack, and started walking down the mountain. But as he left his cage, he took one last look, and there was a little waterfall by the cave. And although the waterfall was just a little trickle of water, the water had worn its way right into the rock over the years. It had worn a channel in the rock. And he thought, that is an example of persistence. That is an example of patience. It just shows you that if you stick at it, you can make a difference. My mind may be like a boulder, but if my meditation can be like that water, eventually it'll work its way through. So, renewed inspiration, he went back into his cave, sat down, started meditating again. 3 years later, he got up, he thought, "I'm not getting anywhere, no sign of Maitreya, I'm not making any real progress," he felt, "with his meditation. I'm going to give up." And he started walking down the mountain. But as he walked down the mountain, just below where his cave was, there was a colony of cliff-nesting birds, maybe like sand martins or something like that. And he just thought, "This is beautiful, it's so lovely." He just sat there watching them for a while. And they nested in holes in the sandstone, and he realised that the wings of the birds had worn the sandstone away around the rim of each of these nesting holes. And he thought, that is amazing. A feather is so soft, but those feathers have actually worn away the rock over the years. That is persistence. That is consistency. I'm just pathetic. I must get back down there and meditate again. He went back in his cave, sat down, started meditating. He did his mindfulness of breathing, he did his metta-bhavana, but he particularly did the practice of the Buddha of Love, the Bodhisattva of Love, and Maitreya. 3 years later...
Oh, God.
Asanga started to wonder whether this was really worth doing. And he thought, I can't carry on with this, I've got to give up. Down the mountain, he went, got all the way to the bottom of the mountain, and he thought, I need to put up somewhere for the night. So he went into, knocked on the door of a little hut, and he said, could you put me up for the night? And a very nice man in there said, yes. He said, what do you do for a living? And he said, I make needles. I'm a needle maker. He said, how do you make needles? He says, well, I get these iron spikes, and I polish them down until I get a needle. And he says, that must take you ages. Yes, it takes a long time. Yeah. So he watched him sort of rubbing these iron... this is what the story... I mean, this, don't know if it's true. This is what the story says. Rubbing these iron spikes... Until he got them down into a needle. And he thought, that is persistence. Wow, you know, that is patience. That's consistency, he says. I'm just pathetic. You know, it's only 9 years after all. I'm going to go back. I'm really going to do it. Went back into his cave, sat down, mindfulness of breathing, metta-bhavana, Maitreya practice. 3 years later, he decided to give up. He thought to himself, I'm not for this business. Meditation, Buddhism, it's not for me. I've given it a good whack, I just cannot do it. He felt very disappointed, very, very downhearted indeed. He thought, the Bodhisattva Maitreya, I haven't had a glimpse of Maitreya. 12 years of practice, nothing has happened. And in a rather despondent mood, he went off down the mountain. He went past the little waterfall. He went past the bird's nest. He didn't give him a second look. He walked past the shop of the needle maker. And he carried on down the path towards the city. Where his teacher lived. But by the side of the path, he saw a dog. And the dog was badly injured. The dog was so badly injured that he had an open wound on his flank. And Asanga looked at the dog, which was sort of whimpering, but couldn't even get stand up. And he thought, this is terrible. Poor dog, you know, it's really in pain. And he went down to the stream and he tore off a bit of his clothing and tried to clean the wound and tried to sort of make the dog a bit more comfortable so that it had a chance to heal up and gave it some food and so on. And this comes to another, but you may know this bit of the story. He noticed in the open wound of the dog there were maggots. And he thought, I must clean up the maggots, I must get rid of them. And then he thought, but these maggots are also living beings, and every day I've been reciting, I undertake the principle of training not to harm any living beings. If I remove the maggots from the dog, they'll all die. And so, according to the story, he cut off a piece of his own thigh with his knife, laid it carefully in the shade, and placed all the maggots, very carefully placed all the maggots in the shed. There's an even more disgusting bit, which I won't go into. And, he lost blood, and he fainted. He fainted. And fortunately, it wasn't fatal. I mean, it was just a little bit of flesh he took off, you know. It wasn't serious. And after a few hours, the moon came up, it was night, and it was cool, and he woke up again. And he looked, and the dog had vanished. And sitting there was the Bodhisattva Maitreya, mm-hmm. where the dog had been. And Asanga was furious, absolutely furious. He said, 12 bloody years, I've been sitting up there doing this practice. You don't turn up until I give up entirely. He said, what are you playing at? And Maitreya looked at him very kindly, being Buddha of Love. He said, well, he says, what you hadn't developed was compassion. You hadn't developed compassion. And it was only that meeting the dog, which was me, in disguise, that developed that compassion. And Asanga, so he lost his aim. He said, oh, well, fair enough. All right, then. So the story says he picked up Maitreya this sort of being of light, I suppose, you know, so very easy to pick up, picked him up, placed him on his head, and walked into the city. And he wanted just to show everybody the Bodhisattva of Maitreya. So he walked all around the city, showing off Maitreya. And the story ends, in the version I read, it says, nobody else was able to see the Bodhisattva Maitreya, and only one old lady was able to see even the dog. Now, Asanga, after that, became, you know, a great teacher after that experience, and after that arising of compassion in him, he became a great teacher, and he felt that he wanted to help other people to go down the route of compassion and also real experience, doing their practice through real comprehension and awareness, mindfulness of their actual experience. So basically the talk's going to be on Asanga's teaching, the school that he started, the third turning of the wheel of the Dharma that he initiated. And the school of Buddhism that he started is known by various names, most commonly as the Yogacara. And Yogacara literally means a life of yoga, but it doesn't necessarily mean coming along here to one of Ying's or Rose's classes in the morning. It means yoga in the more traditional Indian sense of intense practice. So it's the life of intense practice, the kind of intense practice that brings you face to face with your experience, as it should be. So how do you prioritize actual experience in your practice? Try to understand how experience works. And the Yogacara, among many other contributions to Buddhism, it introduced a new psychological approach, and that's why it's relevant to this series that we're doing here on Buddhist psychology. And I'm going to say a little bit about this, particularly one particular element of it. And what Asanga said was, he said the mind has layers to it. He says to understand the mind, you need to realize that there's the surface of the mind, but there are other things that go on more deeply, that go on beyond the immediate reach of your ordinary awareness. And some of these things that go on are helpful, and some of them are unhelpful habits that need dealing with. And meditation and other forms of Buddhist practice are about tackling some of these deeply rooted habits, things that you can't just change by saying, okay, I'm going to, you know, start doing the 2-5 diet or something like that. You've actually got to change something inside, something deeply embedded. So the mind is layered, and the first layer, in a way, this is what we're trying to do in the meditation, is the layer of sense awareness. And so, according to early Buddhist tradition as well as the Yogacara, there are five sense awarenesses or sense consciousnesses. And this is, I'm going to start doing a diagram here. This is not meant to be literally what human experience looks like, but I will put an eye there because that's eye consciousness, an ear there because that's hearing consciousness. Can I do a nose? Something like that. Yeah, that's smelling consciousness. That's the what's her name, Miley Cyrus consciousness, long tongue, and touch. So we've got the five sense consciousnesses. So it's said that this is basically, you know, on the surface level, this is what is happening to us, isn't it? We're receiving all these impressions through our senses. At the moment, you can hear my voice, there's the noise, you've got the vision, you've got the other senses operating as well. And there they are, they're sort of, wherever you're awake, they are operative. And there's also a sixth sense, which is known as the mind sense. And this is what the five senses sort of send their results to, so to speak. I'm going to start a bit of a, seeing it's Easter. So, mind sense. The mind sense consciousness, the sixth sense, but it is an awareness, a consciousness, is receiving impressions from the five senses. It's receiving visual information, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, and tactile. But that's not all, and that's what I hoped you might get through the meditation. I'm sure it's fairly obvious, isn't it, that other things happen in the mind, don't they? It's not just this noise of this voice. There's also something that's done with it that turns it into conceptual meaning, isn't there? But even that, even if there's nothing coming in through the senses, the mind is still active. It may be that you're dreaming, it may be that you're thinking about things, it may be that there are memories arising, it may be that there are plans going on and trains of thought, images popping up in your mind, strong emotions of various kinds, all this kind of thing, which may or may not have been stimulated by sensory experience. If it has been, it may be very indirect. It might be from a long time ago. So the mind is active. So we've got things coming from here, from, as it were, below, from some space, as it were, that lies below the mind. There's another layer. So we've got the layer of the physical senses, we've got the layer of the active mind, and then we've got, at least at first sight, wherever all the stuff comes from that pops up in the mind. Does that make sense so far? So we've got some layers, and we've got these different types of awareness or consciousness. I'm using the word awareness and consciousness sort of interchangeably, because I think sometimes awareness is a better way to look at it. Consciousness is a little bit, sounds a bit sort of academic. So we've got this strong sense of an apparently real outside world. And what the Yogācāra were interested in was not philosophy or even science. It was just what seemed to be going on in experience. It was experience they were interested in and how you can use your experience to move towards liberation. So liberation, awakening, as with all Buddhist schools, is the basic goal of this. So the mind sense integrates the perception, makes sense of the perception coming through the other senses, but it also has stuff coming from somewhere else. Now, this is where Asanga's particular contribution came in, because so far this is already there in the early Buddhist schools. But he wanted to give a name to this place, as it were, that other stuff was coming into the mind from. And he decided to call it the Ālaya. And the word Ālaya means a store or a storehouse. And in fact, can anyone think of a very well-known word in which, in the second half of the word, Ālaya appears? A word that everybody in this room will be familiar with. I'll give you a clue. It's the name of a range of mountains.
Himalayas.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, so the word Hima or Hima means snow. Is that right?
Yeah.
So Himalaya means the storehouse of snow, or the store of snow. And so really it should be pronounced Himalaya, by the way, not Himalaya. So Ālaya is the word for a store, a storehouse. So you've got this sense of this great reservoir, this great granary, from which all this stuff is coming. And that's the word that he used for it. The early Buddhists had already talked about something. They talked about a deep unconscious mind stream, the sort of the flickering of awareness or aliveness in the mind that continues even when you're fast asleep. And they thought that somehow this stream must carry the threads of continuity, because there are these mysterious things, aren't there? Like you go to sleep at night and you wake up in the morning and you're still you. Now, why should you be? I mean, you might wake up in the morning and be somebody else. Not only that, you've still got memories, it seems. So even though you've gone through a period of probably a deep dreamless sleep, somehow there's something that is preserving you and your memories, and not just your memories, but your personality and your habits, all that kind of stuff. So this was the idea of this deep, they call it a bhavanga, the deep mind stream. And of course, for all Buddhists, there was a strong sense of the continuity happening over lifetimes as well. So what is it that would carry some sort of a continuity, given there's no self in Buddhism? And there were people very careful to say, no, the Bhavanga or the Arya is not a self, it's not a thing, it's not fixed, it's a stream. But there is this stream that somehow carries things, carries impulses, consciousness, memories, habits, karmas from life to life. Now, Asanga suggested that this deep unconscious mind stream touches your conscious mind, and that is the source of all these memories and images and the other objects of the mind sense, the storehouse. But the other thing that he said was, this is not a static thing, it's constantly changing. And it's constantly changing because every experience we have, every action that we do, every decision that we make, drops something into the alia, into the storehouse. So it's a little bit like leaves dropping from a tree, or seeds, maybe it's better to put it in seeds, dropping from a tree and landing on the soil underneath. The tree is the conscious mind and the senses, and the land, the ground underneath, is the alia. So you imagine these little lots of little seeds drifting down from the tree, landing on the ground. And of course, the thing about seeds is they're not dead. They're not just little particles. If they reach the right conditions, they will sprout. And so this is the whole idea of karma in Buddhism, that all your actions, even all your experiences, they have repercussions. What you do makes a difference. What you decide makes a difference. How you live makes a difference. Because constantly, every little thought, every word, there's a little piece of thistle down, one of those little helicopter seeds that's sort of and landing in the soil of the alia underneath. And there it sits. And it sits there until the conditions are right, and then the seed sprouts and grows. And that is another thing. The sprouting is another thing coming out of the alia into your mind. So you might think, why did I remember that particular thing at that moment? Well, it's because some process had been set up, perhaps in the distant past, which made it appropriate to you to remember that thing at that particular moment. So that's the idea of the seeds in the alia. And in fact, the alia, as well as being called the store, is also sometimes called a word that means all the seeds, sava bijaka, all the seeds. So this is starting to become, it's developing into a sort of quite a complex psychology, but always it's trying to go back to meditation and trying to go back to our experience and helping us with our experience. Now, Asanga was also concerned about human suffering. He was wondering, why do we suffer? Why do we cause ourselves so much trouble? Now, it may be, of course, because, as with the dog, it's because we're, as it were, physically injured. It may be an illness or something like that. But very often, probably 9/10 of our suffering is not to do with organic causes. Is that true? That's probably true for me, anyway. 9/10 of it is to do with stuff that I add, stuff that I create, stuff that I put on top of my experience that makes things irritating, that makes me feel a lack, that makes me feel annoyed or something like that. So it's because of our deluded way of looking at our experience. So our Sangha felt, I want another layer here. I need another layer. And this layer is here. It's a thin skin between the alia and the mind consciousness. And this one is called the contaminated mind. If you like the Sanskrit words, it's manas for short. Klishto manavijnana, the contaminated mind consciousness, or the manas. So there's a part of the mind which sort of feels as if it's sitting there in the middle of experience, receiving all the sense impressions, as if they're coming in from the outside, all these sense impressions. It also feels it's receiving all these impressions from the depths of our unconscious mind, the storehouse consciousness as well. And because of this, it assumes that there must be an inner self and an outer world. And it's this which causes the world to split into two, into inside and outside. That's why I've deliberately left the bottom of the alia open, because the alia is not an enclosed surface. And what Asanga felt from his own experience and from his teachers and from Buddhism in general as well, is that the splitting of the world into inside and outside is actually a delusion. You don't need to be separated in that way. And it's this contaminated mind, this deluded mind, that tends to do that. In a way, that's its function. Its function is to create the sense of an embattled and needy self, which it creates out of looking within and not being able to see what's going on in the alia. There must be a self there. Looking outside, and in a way not being able to know directly what's happening outside either, just receiving this information through the senses. That must be an outside world. So does this make sense so far? So it's a quite interesting idea, isn't it? And somehow you need to turn this whole thing around, turn it even upside down. Symbolised in the Zen stories by the master placing his sandals on his head. That's what he means by that. He means that we are upside down at the moment. We've got things wrong. And the split is described by Asanga as being a split. He didn't call it the inside and the outside. He called it the grasper and the grasped, which is quite an interesting way of looking at things, isn't it? It's as if this sort of needy bit, it's only a little bit of the mind, but it sort of takes control. It tells us it's the most important thing. It tells us, I am the ego. Give me, give me what I want. It's the grasper, and everything else is seen as the grasped. That's the split that he described. The contaminated mind consciousness. Now, the Yogācāra has a number of different names. It's also called sometimes mind-only, the mind-only school of Buddhism. Or sometimes manifestation-only, which I'm not going to go into that one, but you can sort of think about what that might mean. And this is a bit mysterious, and when the first Western scholars came across these words, mind-only, citta, matra, mind-only, they thought, it must be an idealist school. Mm-hmm. So if you've heard, come across philosophy, you have come across maybe Bishop Berkeley and people like that, who taught that, decided that because we can't have any direct experience of an objective outside world, it must all be happening inside our minds. And the outside world must be illusory. The only reason for Bishop Berkeley that the outside world sort of carries on in a relatively consistent way is because it's all in the mind of God. So God is watching, very, very overworked, I'm sure, watching everything, making sure it still happens, because nothing happens unless it's in awareness, according to Bishop Berkeley. And so the people that came across mind-only school of Buddhism thought, well, this must be an idealist school. It must be a school that believes that everything's happening inside the mind, which is quite reasonable when it's called mind-only, when it has all this this stuff going on about the complexity of the mind. And it does indeed say that you can't say anything definite about the outside world. All you can say is, this is my experience. Now, I don't know whether I can explain why Yogācāra is not really an idealist philosophy. Maybe before doing that, I should say, of course, that idealism in the West is very much a minority position. You'll hardly ever meet anybody who is a follower of Bishop Berkeley and thinks that everything happens inside the mind. Nearly everybody, especially the thinkers, the scientists, the philosophers, think the opposite. They think that everything happens outside the mind. In other words, that reality is objective. And there's even quite a strong sense that mental experience is just, it has no significance in a sense. It's just bubbles. It's a fizzing on the surface of brain activity in a way. So we've gone to the other extreme, where we've gone to the materialist, or sometimes known as the realist extreme, where we think that it's external reality is reality. What we think of as happening inside our mind is something which is just mental activity and is illusory. But Buddhism has never taken either of those two positions. Because what it says is that the split between inside and outside is a mistake. It's not actually there. So one can provisionally start to talk about your mental experience. You can talk about the cars passing outside. That's absolutely fine. But the split between inside and outside is something which in the end you can transcend, and you need to transcend if you're to become liberated. So what Yogacara tried to do was to clarify what experience is like and how perception happens. And they said, they asked a very difficult question, which I'm going to ask you to see what happens. What's the difference between an object and an object in your awareness? And they said, you can't tell. So, when we talk, we take it for granted that there's a table there, and there's also my experience of a table. But what Yogacara said is just, no, there isn't. There is simply experience of a table. That's it. Now, you can infer things and impute things, have theories about things as much as you like, but all that actually is experience of a table. There is one thing, not two things. The object and the experience of an object are not two different things. I'm not sure I understand that myself. So if you don't understand it, I don't blame you because I don't. But does it give you a sort of a hint as to what they're trying to do to heal that rift between the inside and the outside? The idea of inside and outside is something that we add later. We simply have experience. We have perceptions. And we add to our experience and perceptions a feeling tone of whether we like it or don't like it. We also add labels to things, table. We add a storyline, this table has such and such a history behind it, it's used for certain things. And we explain it all to our satisfaction. But this is all activity in the mind that's going on, all these stories, these labels and so on. And before that, a thing and the observation of the thing arise together. The table and the experience of the table are there at the same time, completely dependent on each other. And it's meaningless to talk about an object before we've perceived it. And it would be very grandiose to say that an object only comes into being after we've perceived it, and that we've sort of manufactured it in some way. That'd be terrible, wouldn't it? So materialism is the belief that the table is there before we've perceived it. Idealism is the belief that the table comes into being because we've perceived it. Yogacara says they're both wrong. Okay? And so mentally we divide our experience into the grasper and the grasped, the perceiving consciousness and the thing that's perceived by that consciousness. But the perceiving process and what is perceived are fully integrated in reality. They're not different from each other. We can distinguish them in our language, but they are mutually leaning on each other. The image that the Buddha used when he was talking about form and consciousness was of two sheaves of grain leaning on each other. Take one of them away, the other one falls over. They both, for their structure, they both depend on each other. Now, the manas, the contaminated mind consciousness, sort of sits astride the conscious and the unconscious sectors of the mind. The conscious is above, the unconscious is below, if you like. And it sees all this stuff fruiting, sprouting, germinating from the store, and it mistakes it for an independent self, which seems to be somewhere deep inside me. But it doesn't see that this store is not just a static reservoir of selfhood from which things emerge. It's actually much more like a stream, like a river, as the early Buddhists put it, a stream of consciousness, the Bhavanga. And it only sees a little part of the store as well, a tiny bit of it. It doesn't realise that it just extends and extends and extends. And the storehouse, the alaya, is something vast. If it did see, if the manas saw how vast the alaya was, it could not mistake it for an enclosed, independent selfhood. And in fact, the manas itself is simply something that has sprouted from the alaya. So our belief in self, our sense of separation is just one of the many things that have germinated, have emerged from that deep reservoir or that deep river, underground river, if you like, of conditioning, of experience, of memories, of connections, of interpenetration with everything else. So this sort of bubbles out, this ego bubbles out from the alia, and then it sees the overlap between itself and the store as a sort of a ruling selfhood. Now, to try and get to a better grips of this whole idea, this whole sense of the way the mind works, the Yogacara came up with images. They love to use images for this, rather than philosophical arguments. Although the later Yogacara did also use philosophical arguments, but sometimes they went a bit all over the place, I think. And sometimes the images are more helpful. So I've already mentioned some. What I mean, the first one is this as a store. The second one I mentioned is this as a river. But the one that was most prominent in Asanga's own teaching was the alia as an ocean. So the alia is an ocean, a huge, vast, very deep sea. The store is not an enclosed territory. It's big. It's in a way limitless. And this is why, you know, one might be tempted to say, oh, this is the unconscious mind of Western psychologists. Well, maybe it is, but not in the sense of it even being an individual possession, even being something that each person has a different alia. It's not quite like that. The alia is huge. So it's not really Freud's unconscious, it's not really even Jung's unconscious. From a Asanga's point of view, it's something, in a way, more mysterious almost. And it can't be directly observed, except perhaps after liberation. We only observe what emerges from it. What happens as you become more liberated, as this process becomes weaker and weaker, the ego-making process, it means that the alia becomes more and more transparent. And it's as if you can see what's emerging from it, from deeper and deeper depths. So the ocean is a good image for it. So the forms of experience and awareness are said to be like waves on the surface of the ocean, sometimes very choppy, very disturbed, sometimes just a deep swell. But then the deeper you go, the calmer the ocean is, the stiller it is, and the clearer it is. And the swells that come up from the deeps actually influence the surface, even influence the winds that blow. The winds, if you like, are the input into the senses from what seems to be the outside world. And deep down the ocean is still, it's quiet, it's transparent, but it's also maybe filled with strange creatures, which is an image that the Buddha himself used, a sense of the mighty ocean being filled with mysterious creatures that sometimes break the surface and give you a bit of a shock, perhaps, or a bit of delight. And when the waves are completely still, you can see right down to the bottom, the jewels lying on the sand at the bottom of the ocean. The other, at least another image that's used traditionally for the alia, I've already hinted at, and that's the image of the alia as a garden. The alia as soil. In fact, the alia, in a way, is a vast landscape, a fertile landscape, a varied landscape, a landscape in which all our actions, all our experiences, fall as seeds. But the garden image is a nice one because that gives you the sense of the possibility of cultivating that landscape. So it may be at the moment it's very weedy, it's very full of rubbish, it's contaminated with pollution, it's got huge puddles in it and all sorts of things like that. But you can cultivate it. You can encourage certain things to grow. You can even decide what seeds you want to plant in it. So this is the process of living, as Buddhists would say, a spiritual life or a meditative life, is changing what's happening in that landscape, in that fertile soil of the garden of the alia. The seeds remain dormant for long periods, but when the conditions are right, they sprout, just like ordinary seeds, real seeds, which need certain conditions. They need enough moisture. They need warmth. Some of them need light to be there. They need certain nutrients. And similarly, the seeds that we plant in our soil, they need the right conditions to sprout. And the sprouting of a seed, or the fruiting of the plant, if you like, is an event, is something that happens in your life. That's the way the image works. Now, there are several kinds of seeds. First of all, there are dark seeds and bright seeds. And unfortunately, this is a Tibetan version of the Wheel of Life, but if you look at Chinese versions of the Wheel of Life, you'll actually see the seeds relevant to each of the realms. You'll see what the seeds are. So some realms in the Wheel of Life will have a lot of dark seeds and only a few bright seeds. Others will have a lot of bright seeds and only a few dark seeds. And that is to do with how much skillfulness there is there and how much happiness there is there, the differentiation between the realms. So the dark seeds are the karmic traces of unskillful actions, and the bright seeds are the karmic traces of skillful actions. And the dark seeds are those seeds that ripen into unpleasant experiences, and the bright seeds ripen into pleasant, or at least helpful, experiences. So this is the whole basic Buddhist idea of karma that I'm sure you've come across, but it's an image, maybe, of planting seeds in the garden of your mind that may help you to sort of see how karma is being presented. On these Chinese versions of the Wheel of Life, you'll also often see a third kind of seed. The dark seeds, the bright seeds, and the golden seeds. And the golden seeds are also called Buddha seeds. So these are to remind you of your potential for awakening. And they're not necessarily directly connected with the number of bright or the number of dark seeds. Because even in the darkest periods of life, it said, the potential for awakening can be there very strongly. In fact, if you're in hell, you've got a very strong incentive to gain awakening because you're in a really difficult situation. And so the number of Buddha seeds for people in despair is actually high. I don't think it means that it's a good thing to try and get into despair, but it does mean that there's a little bit of a consolation there, that your incentive, because things are so desperate, your incentive is, I've got to change, I cannot put up with this, it's just too bad. While if you're in one of the middling sort of realms, where things are sort of all right, not too bad, you don't have a very strong incentive, and you may just sort of hang around for ages just living a very ordinary life, you know. So sometimes extremes can be helpful. To put yourself at risk of extremes can be helpful. The Buddha seeds sprout if there's sufficient space and if there's some letting go. You can't force them to sprout. And these are the potential for awakening, the potential for seeing through this whole game of grasper and grasped. Now what you can do is to turn this wasteland that is our mind into a garden by planting more and more of the bright seeds, pulling up any poisonous weeds from the dark seeds, clearing away the rubbish, the pollution, and so on, and make it into a really beautiful garden filled with growing things, something very inviting to the birds and the butterflies, a place of beauty, a place of symmetry. So you can think of the mind in sort of environmental terms, you know, as if you were a member of Friends of the Earth. You were trying to deal with an old contaminated chemical plant area and turn it into a beautiful garden. That's what one is doing with one's mind. You're trying to understand the ecology of your own mind, to restore the balance that needs to be there by the planting of the bright seeds and dealing with the dark seeds. So if you ever wonder, you know, why am I like this? Why is my life like this? Then from a Buddhist point of view, some of it is to do with organic things that may have happened to you, but a lot of it is to do with what you've planted in your mind in the past. And so very narrow, inward-looking, selfish acts will tend to be planting those dark seeds, and those dark seeds eventually will sprout. And what we need to do is to deal with those as they come up, but also plant as many bright seeds as we can, the seeds of openness and creativity, and kindness towards others, and so on. So in the analogy, the mind consciousness is the gardener. The mind consciousness is the gardener who's looking after. This is your conscious self, your deliberate self, who's trying its best to lead a reasonably balanced, healthy human life, plant the bright seeds, deal with the weeds and the mess and the pollution and so on. So the store consciousness, the alia, is the soil of the garden. the garden itself. And what about the contaminated mind? I mean, you could see this as this sort of busybody who keeps coming into the garden, saying he owns the place, it's my garden, erecting walls around it, limiting it, telling the gardener in a very officious and unhelpful way what to do all the time, but actually the gardener knows full well what needs doing. Always anxious, always critical. And the self becomes this little embattled patch walled in the vast landscape of the Alia, with the contaminated mind sort of suspiciously peering over the wall, thinking that everything that comes along is a potential threat or maybe something it can appropriate for its own little castle. Another image that's given, which I won't go into so much, for the Alia, what do we have so far? We've had the storehouse, we've had the river, we've had the ocean, we've had the garden, and the other one is the pregnant woman. So it was suggested that the Alia is like a pregnant woman. In other words, there is something, or many things, that is, you know, potentially emerging, coming into being from the Alia. And the contaminated mind is the abusive boyfriend in this analogy, who thinks he's the father, or insists he's the father, when actually he isn't. But he's just a very, very unhelpful presence in the woman's life. I hadn't come across that one before. I was just reading some of the early texts. That's the pregnant woman and the abusive boyfriend. And then I think maybe this is the last image I wanted to mention. Was something not so much to do with an image for the whole of the Alia or the whole of the eight consciousnesses. I think I'll just write that down so that you can see this, by the way, because this is known as the scheme of the eight consciousnesses. So if we count them up, we'll see we've got eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, touch consciousness. Number six is the mind as a sense consciousness. Number seven is the manas, the contaminated mind. And the eighth consciousness is the Alia. So it's known as the scheme of the eight consciousnesses. Now, the image that was used a bit, not by Sangha himself, but later on, was the image of perfuming. So I'm just going to read you out a quote from Padmavajra on this. If we act out of greed or hate or jealousy or conceit or any of their refinements, their effects don't just vanish into space. They're stored in the store, in the Alia. And the same with good things. If we act out of kindness or love or faith or intelligence, generosity and so on, the effects go into the Alia. And these effects are called vasanas, which means perfume or traces. So as well as using the word seeds, it uses this word perfume. Perfume. And the image, again, that's used in traditional Buddhism for this is placing a jasmine flower in a pot of tea so that the scent of the jasmine spreads through the whole tea. And I was thinking for us, it might be putting a cinnamon stick in a jar of sugar. So there's an effect. So everything that we do perfumes our mind, the depths of our mind. It has an effect. I mean, maybe sometimes it's rather stinky, and sometimes it's much more fragrant. So the depths of our mind are touched or perfumed by what we've done. And when the conditions are right, those traces will be activated. We maybe will do those same things again, or we'll suffer the consequence of those actions, or we'll suffer the benefits of those actions. So, left to itself, the contaminated mind, the manas, takes over the mind consciousness and it turns it into this frantic, egotistical, self-oriented monkey mind, constantly grasping, self-protective, deluded, and thus sowing the garden full of dark seeds. So what do you do? Well, you could just sit on it. You could sit on the monkey, you could stifle the contaminated mind. But what would then happen would be that the Alia would just run on of its own accord. you go on to autopilot, in other words, and sometimes I'm sure this you must know where this happens, where your conscious mind is not particularly involved. Maybe you go on a, do they call it highway trance? You're driving. When you reach your destination, you realise you can't remember the journey at all. You were in a way, you were somewhere else. You were on autopilot. You were presumably driving safely since you've arrived without crashing into anything, but you just can't remember it. And I think quite a lot of our lives we spend like that. We just let the alia, because after all, the alia is full of learning. The alia is where all our habits are stored, all our learning is stored. And many things we can do automatically. We can manage them automatically. We, you know, there are some things which are autonomic, which we're breathing and our heart rate and so on, but there are other things as well. Once we've learned to ride a bicycle, once we've learned to drive a car, once we've learned to get up in the morning and go through, stagger through the motions of cleaning our teeth and having a shave and all that sort of thing. You can do this. You can let the alia do it all, which is okay up to a point, but it does mean that you're on autopilot. You're not actually there while your life is happening. And so, very obviously, I suppose, the answer, the middle way between either the frantic monkey mind doing everything in a busybody sort of way on the one hand, or being on the autopilot of leaving the alia to handle everything, the middle way is mindfulness. So mindfulness is the key, is the thing that takes you beyond the contaminated mind and starts settling the alia until it becomes more and more transparent. Mindfulness is the middle way. Apply that as strongly as you can to every event, to every experience. And you apply mindfulness as the seeds ripen, as they fruit, and you apply it whenever you decide to intervene in life. You act with self-awareness. So you'll perfume the garden with beautiful perfumes, and those beautiful perfumes come from mindful practice. And you can see why the regularity of practice is so important, because we're constantly dropping seeds into the alia. So it's very important what they are that we drop. And we need to be aware of that. If we can be mindful, if we can be present, not worried, not anxious, but just present, open, delighted in our experience, then the bright seeds will drop and the perfume, the beautiful perfume from those flowers will rise. And then the waves will die down. Sorry, I'm mixing my metaphors here, but we see deeper and deeper into the great ocean of the store. And the garden is able to grow into something which combines wildness with order, organic beauty. And eventually, according to Asanga, the store itself changes, it transforms, it flips over. It's called the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, the paravritti. So the highest teaching of the Okalchara is this transformation of consciousness. And it's said that the store, the alia, transforms into a mirror. It transforms into what's called the wisdom like a mirror. The wisdom associated with the blue Buddha of the eastern direction, if you're familiar with the mandala. The wisdom that is like a mirror. The wisdom which simply reflects everything as like it is. As exactly as it is, without any distortion, without any self-involvement, just there it is, as it is. And so another image you can use for the process of dealing with a contaminated mind is polishing, cleaning the mirror, getting the dust off the mirror. And you'll find that image used a lot also in Zen Buddhism and Chinese Buddhism. And then you have this mirror-like, beautiful mirror-like awareness. And the mirror-like wisdom is what we use to free the store from that abusive and possessive boyfriend, if we see it in terms of the pregnant woman, or from the obsession, the attachment to the contaminated mind, so fixated on that sort of walled area it thinks of as me. So I'll read out to finish, and we may have a few minutes for questions. I'll just read out parts of a poem that tries to describe, written by Thich Nhat Hanh, that tries to describe this process of the alia. He says, "Mind is a field in which every kind of seed is sown. The mind field can also be called all the seeds. In us are infinite varieties of seeds of samsara, seeds of nirvana, delusion and enlightenment, seeds of suffering and happiness, seeds of perceptions, of names and of words, seeds that manifest as body, seeds that manifest as the mind, seeds that manifest as the realms of being, the stages of progress, and all the worlds. All these are stored in our deep consciousness, which is why it is called the store. Some seeds are innate, handed down by our ancestors. Some seeds were sown while we were in the womb. Others were sown when we were children. Whether transmitted by family, friends, society or education, all our seeds are by nature, both individual and collective. The quality of our life depends on the quality of the seeds that lie deep in our mind. The function of the store is to receive and maintain the seeds and their habit energies so they can manifest in the world or remain dormant. When delusion is overcome, understanding is there, and the store is no longer subject to afflictions. The store consciousness becomes the great mirror wisdom, reflecting the cosmos in all directions. So that's the teaching of Yogacara, the teaching of Asanga. And it has been very influential, especially in East Asian Buddhism, this particular sort of psychological model. So if you find it interesting, you can read up a bit more about it. Look up Asanga, look up Yogacara. Any questions? Yes.
My question, and my main difficulty with my question is, I really like the whole model, but apart from the concept of cultivating positive seeds over negative seeds, rather than what feel connected with is the path of authenticity, which is accepting a negative seed as an equal to a positive seed without any judgment of or direction of positive or negative.
Well, I think maybe one way to look at that is to say that there are times when we can sort of gaze into the depths of the Arya, and when you're doing that, you're simply seeing what is there. That's all you're doing. So that's open practice. That's pure practice of awareness, yeah. But there are times when this is where you are, actually. Like it or not, you're actually in mind consciousness. You're in active consciousness. And that's what mind does. It makes discriminations. So even that discrimination you've made of preferring the idea of not judging the seeds to the idea of judging them, this is something that's coming from mind consciousness. We do it all the time. So actually, both have their validity. So sometimes you need to look into the transparent depths of the Arya, just see what's there. As you say, you don't even know what it's going to sprout into. But sometimes you actually need to deal with the sprouts, because those things sprouting, they may be an impulse, for example, to say something really horrible to somebody. And if you have the sense that, no, everything is equally fine, it makes no difference, then you may find you're in a sort of antinomian position where you feel that ethics, for example, makes no difference. You know, your ethical decisions make no difference. So I do think that you need to give mind its due, and that's discriminating mind, and sometimes it has its role to play. But I also agree with you completely. There's also the role of just gazing into the depths of the eye and opening up to whatever is there. Does that help at all, looking at it in that way?
Yeah. My only question is, I guess, the question of ethics and where that even comes from.
Yeah.
From what you just said.
Yeah, well, it is interesting because East Asian Buddhism was strongly influenced by Taoism. And Taoism tends to have that embracing, open attitude that, in a way, whatever arises is simply what arises. But Buddhism brought in that attitude. It was there in early Buddhism. But it also brought in the discriminating attitude. And it's quite interesting, the tension between the two. So it did bring in a sense of, it didn't talk about right and wrong, but it did talk about skillful and unskillful. It talked about those decisions that will tend to lead to greater happiness for yourself and others, and other decisions that will tend to lead to greater unhappiness. And so the possibility of making a choice. And sometimes we are trapped into too much anxiety and too much choice making and too much judgment. But we can also be trapped in quiescence, where we're not doing enough of that. So I think that's why Buddhism called itself a middle way. It said always you're not moving to either of those extremes, neither the quiescence of Taoism nor the sort of very highly judgmental, rule-based approaches of some other traditions. But you're sort of trying to weave a way in between the two. A very difficult thing to do. But thanks for that question, yeah.
Thank you, Ken.
Any other thoughts?
To do with karma, we often sort of, I think, get kind of caught up in prejudging our actions. You know, should I do this? Is it good? Or should I do that? Is it bad? And it, to me, it seems that it's, of course, it's relevant, your action, but what really determines the perfume, whether it's a good perfume or a bad perfume or seed, you know, light or dark, is the feeling or the experience that that action produces. And it's a very, and I feel that the focus could be, or should be, you know, needs to be more on the feeling that an action produces.
I think you're right, David. I think that after a while, your learning proceeds, doesn't it? And you can be more intuitive about the decisions that you make.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes you do think things through as well. Again, it's like both of these faculties have some value, I think.
Yeah, and with that, then you can just sort of, like, you know, not just look at what you do, whether, you know, your actions and what feelings they were, you know, the feelings
yes.
that the actions have produced, but the state of mind you're in, period.
Yes, look at the state
and
of mind you're in.
Is that the state of mind
yeah.
you're in? Or not.
You have a sense of the
motivated in just changing the state of mind as a thing in itself.
Yes, yeah, I agree. Yes.
Rather than sort of, you know, doing this or doing that, which might be motivated
yeah.
In other things that could have good or bad
sure. yeah.
feeling, consequent feelings, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah,
but,
thanks.
You know, also just knowing how you feel, because
yeah.
just changing that.
No, I do agree, Dave. Leave it there and we'll just
yeah.
see if there's any other
thoughts. You can't change how you feel. Isn't the feeling coming from the alia?
It's coming,
isn't
that yeah,
coming?
Right.
Isn't a feeling, like that would seem like that, make, you know, if you when you do things or think things, the feelings associated are the kind of reaction from deep within you.
Yeah.
That is the alia kind of reacting. You know,
so that's why there's a learning process, isn't there, I think, that gradually you'll have a sense of what perfumes certain things have and what things that are perfumed in a certain way you want to encourage, you want to give energy to, and what things you want to withdraw energy from. So there's an interaction between some stuff coming from your unconscious mind and stuff coming down from your own decisions. And there's a long learning process involved, which does involve feelings and intuitions, and I think those are sometimes undervalued. I wonder if we need to stop, don't we? Yeah, we need to... It is 12:30 now. Next week, we've got Mitrananda, who is a psychiatrist, and he's going to be talking about comparisons between Western psychology and Buddhist psychology, so that should be very interesting.
Thank you very much.